First, we'll have the minutes. Did you get mine?
Okay.
All right. They're not reflecting the current minutes.
Well, I understand that. Does anybody have any input on the minutes for July? Need a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Second?
I'll second.
Okay. All in favor of approving the minutes?
Aye.
Any nays?
I'll abstain.
Okay. All right, minutes approved. Okay. Updates to receive. We got the funding update. Anybody have any input or want to hear updates on funding update? Metro station, any input? King Street Metro Rail. North Potomac Yard, small area plan.
Oh, yes, and then I'll update about that.
Safe track update? Nothing. City strategic plan? Okay, the only thing we got is North Potomac Yard.
I can provide an update. Where we are in the planning process is an enormous, Commissioner Jones is sitting on the advisory group, so I won't go into great detail because I know you probably also have updates to provide. The advisory group met approximately a month ago to provide a recommendation. Staff had a recommendation, a preferred alternative for the small area plan. And the advisory group provided input on that and support for the staff recommendation. And then the staff actually then provided, I think the subsequent week, an update to the Planning Commission, and there was a work session on that item. The next steps in terms of transportation is that we are working on the transportation study, and we will be holding a couple of advisory group meetings specific to transportation later this year. I believe starting in December, and then have a meeting with the advisory group in January and February on transportation. So what we plan to do is come before the Transportation Commission and update you as well during that time. I believe we have it slated for December. Is that right, Steve? That we will come December, January timeframe. Okay. We'll be coming to the Transportation Commission and providing an update on that plan to you.
Okay.
So. And we would come back to you also before we go to plan. When we get to the point where we want to approve the plan, we would have a commission endorse, ask for its endorsement to make sure it's consistent with the transportation master plan prior to going to the planning commission and council.
Okay. Any other questions? Ryan?
Just my update was going to be so there was two options about the path of Potomac Avenue. And the 2010 plan had it more closely mirroring the park, and now it's sort of where it's currently resides, with some elaboration in this area around the proposed metro station. We were kind of surprised with at the Monday meeting was the developers proposing the heights of the buildings, and it's about 50 to 80%, depending on the parcel, of what their maximum could be. Mm-hmm. So, I think that might have impact to projected property tax revenues and other revenues. In the transportation plan, the number of people of trips generated from this for the metro station. So,
depending on the density.
Yeah.
Right.
So the density, I think, is less than anticipated in the 2010 plan. And then they were saying that, well, the density will shift to other parts of that land bay F, but the initial phase is going to be 1.3 of a total build-out of 7.5 million. So if this is a little bit less than originally anticipated, it'll have to go, somewhere else in the bay, but then that's further into the future. It's a subsequent phase. So, for instance, this parcel here identified as number 15, is 55 feet and two stories, whereas according to the FAA height restriction, and the 2010 plan, that could have gone up to about 180 feet instead. So,
well, I think I'll let staff answer that, but it's probably two things depend on. One is whether the developer feels he can get occupancy. Mm-hmm. You know, if there's a demand there, and the other is the height restriction is an FAA requirement. But I assume city staff is looking at the changes, how it affects traffic. But you know, that grid's pretty much nailed down. I'm not sure what much you can do with the traffic thing is.
The grid isn't, so the grid from the 2010 plan to this plan isn't substantially different. The only difference is kind of what Ryan mentioned with the Potomac Avenue portion is, the shifting of Potomac Avenue is the major change. But in terms of building heights, I know that was discussed on Monday night. I believe that staff will be updating the advisory group shortly, kind of regrouping after the feedback that we got at that meeting.
Okay. Anybody else? Okay, we put those aside. Commission update.
I have a commission update.
Okay.
I was appointed to the Landmark Van Dorn, or rather Eisenhower West Landmark Van Dorn Implementation Advisory Group. We had our first meeting, it was last Wednesday at the Victory Center. I had never been in that building. It's a nice little place. It was kind of interesting to be there. We discussed kind of what the role of the group's going to be, kind of how we're going to, you know, the things that are going to be done. We got a good update of the plan forward. The main projects and studies that are coming up right now are, one of them is an air quality analysis. The purpose of that is to make sure that, if you're aware, the Covanta plant is right there and it's not going anywhere. And that has emissions, I believe it's nitrogen oxides and different things. And since they're planning on putting a series of fairly tall buildings around the Covanta plant, they have to ensure, you know, the airflow around the plant all of a sudden changes. They have to ensure that all floors in that building, you know, are going to comply with air quality standards on that basis. And they have to model to see how much air will change, you know, the airflow will change around the plant when it's going to be surrounded by large buildings. So kind of that's one of the big things that's coming up. That'll take time. It's going to start in early October and be completed by mid-January 2017. There's also an infrastructure plan, which is to analyze and facilitate coordination and efficient use of resources for the planning for things like utilities, stormwater sewers, sewer upgrades, planned streets and such. The scope of the work for this particular part of the project is still in development. We expect a notice to proceed to come in spring 2017. And the final piece is just a development overview, kind of a look at how everything is going to be laid out in that area, the planning area. And that's really all we did. The next meeting is going to be sometime in November. I have a few proposed dates, but it hasn't been ironed out yet. I'll make sure to update the commission when that information becomes available.
Okay. Question for staff. The Covanta plant, that's been around a while. I mean, has it exceeded its lifespan? How long is it going to be?
I think the lease goes for another 30 years.
Until 2037 or something. Yeah.
Okay. It'll be around.
Mm-hmm.
Has anybody been there inside?
We took a tour of it last year during Eisenhower West Small Area Planning Process.
Amazingly simple design.
Yeah, but I mean, actually,
but it smells
driven
like
the vehicle
it's
up
horrible.
In there, backed off and unloaded.
I would not want to look in that building.
Inclined to
probably don't smell it after the third one.
Okay.
I don't know if it's
I have one more update. The ad hoc advisory group on Confederate Streets and Memorials wrapped its work and advanced to council, and council made its decisions on that. Things to note to the committee that will be changing, particularly guarding our issues. The statue at Prince Street in South Washington, the city will be asking for permission from the General Assembly to potentially move that. There were some issues raised about it also being a traffic hazard at that location. The city will be renaming the Jefferson Davis Highway, and then the city agreed with the ad hoc recommendations on publicizing the process by which street names are changed in the city, but not moving forward with a wholesale renaming process at the moment.
Mr. Chairman, can I add to that? We also encourage the staff to reach out to Arlington, because if this name change with the Jefferson Davis Highway, because if that name changes, right, that should change together at the same time. Now, because they're a county, they've got to go to the Commonwealth Transportation Board. But if we can agree on the name when we want, then we can go ahead. They can go to the Commonwealth Transportation Board with the same proposal. I got to tell you, the feedback and the firestorm that's created. I just checked today the Washington Post article on this action has 1,400 comments so far from all over the country, and we're getting a lot of emails from all over the country, and it's apparently part of the extended white supremacist network, I think, is most of it. So it's it really, I spoke to the Voice of America yesterday about it, so it's been quite a big deal.
Well, along with that, I want to commend James for volunteering, and he probably didn't know he was getting into this firestorm. You were probably gritting your teeth.
I was the only person who wasn't on another commission at the time, so.
It was your turn, as they say.
Didn't really have an option.
Okay, well, I appreciate you sitting in there for it and getting input, and you're a reasonable voice, so I'm sure you.
That was a great report. Yeah. Could I have another report to give on the Transportation Planning Board?
Sure.
Just met today, and we have a task force that's been working on the issue of developing a regional long-range plan. As part of that is to look at unfunded projects. You know, we have a constrained long-range plan, the CLRP. If you want any federal funding, you got to get on the CLRP, but you also have to have funding secured in order to get on that list. Well, a lot of people have said, well, what about the unfunded projects? Aren't those important? Shouldn't we start thinking about them? So what we're moving towards is to first take the staff has gone around and gotten everybody's long-range plans, every city, county, state, WMATA, and taken all of the projects and assembled them. And it turns out to be about 550 projects that will cost about $100 billion. And the analysis by the staff is that if you build all of those projects, traffic congestion will be 32% worse than it is today. So that's what you get for $100 billion. Now, if you just do the constrained long-range plan, it would be 72% worse. And if you do nothing, it would be 100% worse. So, you know, well, it's all relative. So. But what we're on course to do is we have a phase one and phase two. Phase one is to take everybody's project and assemble it and attach it to the CLRP as like the unfunded portion of the long-range plan. So the long-range plan we're going to be talking about tonight will be part of the regional long-range plan. But then phase two, which is we really need to focus on game changer projects. I'm just going to use all kind of the most popular rhetoric. The projects and the programs that would really make a difference in this region, that maybe can get us to the point of reducing traffic congestion, that everybody can agree, although they're unfunded, that they're a priority, and that then the Transportation Planning Board can rise up and say, here you go. Here's the limited set of projects, 5, 10, whatever. And to go to the funding agencies and say, we encourage you to fund them, and then for the Transportation Planning Board to go to the federal government on its own to seek funding, perhaps, for some of these projects. So that's a process that will start then next year. We talked about doing criteria, and we gave up on that because it was too controversial. We tried defining a network, we gave up on that because it's too controversial. So we're going straight to picking the projects. And then talking to the staff, we floated the idea of how about going to each jurisdiction and asking for nominations of projects. And the consensus of the task force was to say, forget that, we can do it. You know, so I said, well, perhaps you would want to consult with your local jurisdiction, but the current feeling is that the Transportation Planning Board will, this task force will start by trying to pick out those kind of projects and then we'll eventually try to, you know, get to this agreement. Now, you know, I doubt if we'll get 100% agreement, but just to show you the ones that are always rise to the top, 8-car trains on every metro train, repair and change in some way the American Legion Bridge and a new metro tunnel at Roslyn. I mean, I'd say those are the three that get the, and one pet project of mine that I'm going to keep peddling is in 51 of our metro stations, there are people who live and work within a quarter mile who can't get there without driving. And so if we can just do, and so I said, let's bundle some bike ped projects around these metros, around our metro stations. Mm-hmm. And you can, for a reasonable cost, you can trigger transit-oriented development.
Yeah.
And,
absolutely.
Yeah. So so that's one I'm going to keep pushing to be included as
part
of that project. So. Anyway, it's an interesting process, and because a lot of people said, Transportation Planning Board, what do? You know, I mean, and we said, well, we got the CLRP and everything, and all these federal requirements, but there's always this feeling like, hey, your name sounds like you're coming up with some regional plan and finding some priorities, and so we're actually trying to do that.
Now, when they consider, you know, like our long-range plan, do they consider regional projects that are multi-jurisdictional?
Well, they're actually just taking
the list and
local projects, regional projects.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, and as you say, the bike ped issue around each metro station, once Metro Rail gets working, it's we're not talking a whole lot of money. It's not like building a road.
It's like $1 million, $2 million a piece, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing the percentage of people that can't get there that are that close.
Yep.
That's a solvable problem.
Yep. And lots of it is these people, the community say, oh, that station, you know, everybody uses that station. Actually, it's the next town over. It's right on the town line, so why do we care about that? Well, if you bundle enough of these, it becomes a regionally significant matter. You know, it's not really local projects in so many cases because the metro stations serve multiple jurisdictions. So,
that's something maybe we should look at for our long range plan is look and say, okay, we have all these projects, but you know, in the big picture of things, how about trying to get people close to metro on metro, get them out of their cars? I mean, that's one of the biggest things we're dealing with. I mean. Our public is,
and that's to get the West End plan, or the West Eisenhower plan further along. I'm sure those kinds of projects will probably appear. And we do have one, don't we? Do a little pedestrian tunnel at Braddock at some point.
That's been in the works for a little while. But it's, you know, it's projects like that you know, if we can increase, you know, bike traffic. So, yeah.
In some cases, it's just a path, a cinder path through the woods, you know, or whatever. So.
Yeah, and I know the commission last month endorsed the Van Dorn Multimodal Bridge for the
there's
the
another
smart
one.
Scale.
Absolutely.
That's something that would provide that multimodal connection to the metro. So.
Oh, I think that would, that one there is a fine example of people can't get from point A to the metro station.
Right.
So. That's a good example. That's an expensive one, but I mean, like Tim says, you know, sometimes you just put in a path and that will increase it. Okay.
Update on dash items. There was a recent schedule change that was put into effect a month ago. One of the most significant changes was the rerouting of the AT-8 bus. And instead of terminating now at Fairfax, it goes directly to Braddock, so it's a continuous loop, metro station to metro station, including the extension out to Van Dorn that alternate routes have within the dash 8 schedule. So that's proven to be well received by the customer base. We've seen increased ridership in the 3-4 line. That's the ridership bus that has serviced the Pentagon, but very much tied to the State Track Initiative and offloading some of the traffic that normally would seek the WMATA Metro Rail System, the use of the 3-4 bus that was made available and extending the service during the day also provided options for the people of Alexandria. And the general manager, Sandy Modell, announced earlier in summer that she was leaving and retiring, and right now the board is engaged in an executive search to secure a new general manager. On the motor coach task force, we had our fourth meeting last week, and we unanimously approve the policy statements that are going to be used for the ultimate decision making in the determination of recommendations for loading and offloading of passengers in connection with the motor coach service in the Old Town area. But with the work that we did at the first, second, and third meetings as far as developing criteria and doing voting discussion process, we were able to, I think, make a very good accomplishment of approving staff's recommendations for the policies with some minor modifications, but I think that's a significant accomplishment for this group in particular, since the previous motor coach groups have not really gone this far as having a consensus position. It'll all be up to meeting number five.
No pressure.
None whatsoever. We're cautiously optimistic.
Yeah. Is Dash or the city going to recognize Sandy at some point?
We will have, yeah, we will definitely have a celebration for Sandy. She's been a great general manager.
And a legacy person.
She started from the,
yes. Right. It was a small, very small operation.
We wouldn't have Dash over her.
Her departure is, I don't think we have a confirmed date yet, but it's coming in the next few months, and so we'll be sure to have let you all know about the
Any other?
Vision Zero is slowly moving along. We should have something more formal to present to the commission at the next meeting. Hillary has been circulating, I believe, a draft resolution on Vision Zero, reaching out to various committees. Is that correct?
Yes.
And then we will be having a subcommittee meeting in early October, and then a something more substantive to bring to the commission at the next meeting.
Okay. Any other updates? None. Okay. Transportation long range plan. Okay, this is a public hearing. We will cover the input that the commission has and the staff, and then we'll open it up to the public. We have the forms out. Anybody want to comment? Okay, as long as they're available, then. Okay.
Okay, so tonight, what we want to do is hold a public hearing, as the chair mentioned, on the Transportation Long Range Plan for 2016. This will be, I believe, the fourth time we've come to you over the process of the LRT update. And ultimately, we would like to ask the Transportation Commission to endorse the 2016 Transportation Long Range Plan. So this just kind of shows the schedule overall over the since the spring. We start out giving an overview of the LRQ process and receive some opportunity guidance. Then in May, we provided an overview of what staff is recommending in terms of new projects and studies. We also talked about at that time taking some of the projects off the project list and moving them to a developer contingent list, which the commission would endorse. Then we, over the summer, the commissioners reviewed each of the, on the project list, reviewed each of those projects and scored them and came back to give the, what the rankings were, received additional commission input, and then at the last meeting, the commission did, in the summer, there was a proposal to use a different scoring methodology for ranking projects, and at the last meeting, the commission did approve using the previous methodology that's been done for previous plans. So, again, tonight, we want to ask for your approval. Just to give background, because I know Melissa's fairly new to the commission, but the LRP is really, it's projects that we pull from various very small area plans, the Ped Bike Master Plan, corridor studies, so they're unfunded projects, unlike the CIP, which has funded projects. So every year we do an update where we score and rank the projects, and we use these projects. Then, as we update the CIP, we'll go back and look at the LRP to see which projects potentially moved up to the CIP. And there were a number of projects that we did add this year, based on very small area plans that were approved for the last year, including the Oakville Triangle, Route 1 Oakville Triangle Corridor Plan, the Eisenhower West Small Area Plan. There's also the Pedestrian Bicycle Master Plan that was updated. So we pulled some key projects from all those plans, put them into here. We also, as I said, we pulled some of the projects off and put them to a developer contingent list. And those are projects where we said, you know, it doesn't make sense to rank those projects because it's dependent on when the developer comes in. So we have those on the other list. And then We also made some minor changes to the studies list. So this shows the this table shows the ranking based on the methodology that was endorsed by the commission. In the second column, so you can compare the 2016 ranking to how they were ranked in 2015. The projects that are underlined, those are the new projects that we've added for this year. And you've seen us, we did make a couple changes from the last meeting, two meetings ago, where we swapped out a couple of the rankings on the projects. But again, this is the list of the projects. I'm not going to go through this in detail unless you have any questions. But in your packet, we have the list of the projects. We also have the studies list in your packet, as well as the development project list. So with that, I'll turn it back to the commission to ask any questions or hearing.
Just to enlighten you, Melissa, like you said, there was a lot of changes, and yes, it's complicated. But you know, we go through it in detail and kind of discuss this, and then each of us rank it, and then they put it in a bucket and spin it, and comes out with the ranking. Well, there's a method to do this, and you know, we looked at the method and kept it with the old system. But what happens is we had a lot of changes from last year to this year. You know, we added some, we subtracted some, and this happens every year. And so then you have to look at it and say, okay, now what's really most important? If you look in your book, they'll have the criteria, and we've actually updated that about 2 years ago, is what's the best way to evaluate projects. And so it's a pretty good system, you know. So the whole purpose here is next year's budget is hopefully they'll have enough money so they can start funding some of that. The list moves slow. Some of these items have been on here for 10 years. And, you know, after a while, sometimes, you know, they drop off because something else changes. But it's, there's never enough money. I think, it's $80 million on there or something like that. And I think we funded less than 10. Yes. So you can see it moves slowly up there. But, you know, that's why we don't spend a whole lot of time discussing the ones on the lower end. It's a top five, top ten that really have a really good chance of funding. And also the funding criteria is such that there's a price tag on each one of those, and if there's any money, sometimes they'll look down and say, okay, we've only got $500,000, and they'll say, well, what can we fund? Oh, here's one we can do for $400,000, you know, and so that just because it's number one doesn't mean it's the next one on the list. It's, you know, there's some criteria to do that. So hope that confuses you very much.
The other thing I was going to mention is from last year's LRP, there were a number that we actually pulled off the list, too.
Yes, that too.
They either had been completed or studies.
Something changed. Yeah.
Yeah, like, for example, the Eisenhower West Smart, when there were projects in here that were on the west side of the city, from years ago, and when we did the Eisenhower West Mario plan, that traffic analysis and the recommendations showed that improvement wasn't needed anymore, so we took it off the list.
I think there was a couple that we combined, and then there was, I know, one that we split off into two because it made more sense. So there's a lot that goes in this, but the important ones are the top five, because the rest of them, the only way some of the other ones would get funded if a developer comes in and wants to do something, that we can get him to pay for some of that. That's usually the smaller stuff. Okay, so does the commission have any discussions you want to bring up on this? Because we've kind of, not saying we beat this horse, but we've certainly discussed it quite a bit. Okay, I'll open the public hearing, and we got one input. Jim Durham. Input.
Jim Durham, 11622 Fort Williams Parkway, Alexandria. I'm speaking as a resident in front of a citizen tonight. First of all, some of you know this is probably the fourth year I've watched the Transportation Commission go through its process. It's probably this group of commissioners has done, I think, tremendous work, done a great job. I commend the staff. I think going through and pulling all the projects from the various plans and get them on here, I think combined is probably the best product I've seen come out of Transportation Commission in 4 years I've been watching. So I just want to mention that. So my comments tonight, therefore, are really based on going forward, what happens, and the chair touched on that. The plan needs to have at least a certain portion of it funded each year, and I think it was 2 years ago we watched things come back onto this list because of the first edge of the WMATA bill and other expenses, and there wasn't enough. And we know this year that there's at least two big major budget issues in the capital funding for schools and in the increased expenses for WMATA. And so I would like to encourage staff and the commission to think about how in the next month, before the council's offsite in the retreat in the November, you can communicate to them the importance of this list, the cost. You might take things like, hey, here's the whole list, but we know it's not realistic to do the whole list of the year, but if you were on a 5-year plan to do the first 20, here's what that would cost. But you got to put a face to the name and convey the importance of these projects and what the money needs in the budget, and encourage them to be resourceful in funding these, what I call internal projects, and not let the money we need to pay to WMATA just take all the money out of transportation and make this list longer. So my request to the commission tonight and to the staff is forcefully and forcibly communicate to council the importance of these projects to the city and what it's going to take financially so that they are best prepared to deal with that in the budget guidance to the city manager that they'll decide on in November. So you need to be communicating in October, probably after your October meeting. I just questions on that? That's all I have. Again, you guys did a great job, commission, did a great job, staff. The challenge is conveying that to council, because once council understands it, that they'll do something with it. I have a lot of confidence in council too, but you have to put a face to a name and bring this message home. Thank you.
Thanks for your input, and yeah, I agree. Each year that I've been on the commission, it's a challenge, I guess I could use that word, to emphasize the city council that with the WMATA bill coming in a large amount, it just depleted what money we had, so we didn't basically fund very much. So it's difficult times, and yes, we have to go in and, like everybody else, go in and fight for the money and how important it is. There's a lot of arguments, and the public has a lot of input of what's more important. But our job is to go to City Council and say we think these are worth funding to make city a better place. That's it. Yeah, we'll probably send our annual letter to City Council with those recommendations. That's it. Any more discussion from the commission?
I would just like to point out along the lines of what Mr. Durham commented on driving here, coming down Seminary Road. There were two joggers running on Seminary Road, running
on the road
east on Seminary Road where there is no sidewalk, going down around the corner down that hill right by this. And all I was thinking, Vision Zero, I saw a car whipping up Seminary, and I was just like, oh my gosh, if there were bike lanes there or sidewalks, it would be a lot safer. So I think these projects are there for a reason, and we can't lose sight of that, and so continuing to press for implementation is key, and extra money, and some of the improvements can be done in conjunction with complete streets. So I think it's just a matter of staying vigilant, because I have seen, I think we've seen projects drop because they were in the long-range plan, and for example, developers didn't implement what they potentially should have, so there were missed opportunities. So I think, I guess it's our job as a commission to make sure that as projects continue, that we stay vigilant to and encourage city to implement projects in conjunction with development and complete street projects. So it's just important.
Yeah, I'm a big proponent of Vision Zero, and it's moving along, and I think next year's long-range plan will take that more into account. We can look at all this and say, what's important? What's really important is, you know, the safety of our residents and our visitors. I'm not sure we can have something else that's more important to that. I know there's a lot of criteria, but, you know, if we want to keep people alive, keep people from getting injured, to me, that's a top priority. Okay, so any other input on the long-range plan? Okay, here.
I move to approve the 2016 Transportation Long-Range Plan as was scored by the Transportation Commission and advanced by staff.
Any
second?
Okay. Any more discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any nays? Unanimously approved. Thank you. Okay. Takes care of that. I-395 Express Lanes. We have a presentation this evening. We can go over what the latest is on that.
Yes, and if I may, I've just introduced the project manager from VDOT, Susan Shaw, as well as Amanda Baxter from VDOT, Tim Rosenblum. Glad you changed your name tag because it had a wrong name. I don't know if anybody else from.
They came to consulting team.
Okay, consulting. We lost one. Okay. But VDOT and VRPT are going to do a presentation to update the commission. Just so all of you know, there's also going to be a public hearing on this project in October. Do we have the location confirmed for that?
Yes, Francis Hammond.
Francis Hammond High School. It's on the
26th, I believe.
26th, yeah. Okay. So with that, I will turn it over to VDOT.
So we're going to kind of tag team. There's three of us here. I'm the overall project manager. Amanda's been working on our NEPA document, our environmental assessment, and then Tim Roseboom is working with DRPT to lead our transit study. I am, you know, we do have a number of slides. I'm going to kind of give the very high level brief. And then if there's questions at the end, you know, we can certainly dive more deeply into it. So we'll give you a brief project update, what we're doing at EADS, our NEPA document, and then our transit study, and then a brief on the overall schedule. Existing conditions, I think you guys pretty much know this corridor, there's a lot of traffic. And so we have focused on, you know, some of the existing congestion, and especially focusing on improving the interchange at EADS Street. And the capacity there. The purpose and need is to reduce congestion. We are providing additional travel choices through the conversion of the HOV lanes to an express or a hot lane system, improving travel predictability and roadway safety. The project background, this is being done under the 95 Express Lanes Agreement that contemplated the development of these northern express lanes in the contract. And so back in November of 2015, the department signed a framework agreement that broadly outlined the roles and responsibilities as we move through to get to a finalized proposal. So we're working to finalize scope. We're working jointly with Transurban, who's the provider. They go by 95 Express, so you'll see that as their corporate name. But there's no guarantee that we're going to end up with a final agreement. But that is how we're currently working on the project, and I'll talk about roles and responsibilities as we move through this early step. The toll project will provide long-term transit investment through the tolling and an annual transit payment, and we do anticipate that the improvements are largely going to be built within the existing right-of-way. The one area where that's not the case is the sound walls. Sound walls will be in our right of way, but bump up against adjacent communities where they are built. This is now being done in the context of our Atlantic Gateway project. Virginia was very successful in getting a $165 million grant from the Federal Highway Administration through that program, a national program. I think we are the largest recipient. It's a multimodal project, so there's a number of other projects happening at DRPT related to rail, providing the third track for VRE, and then this project in particular, which is also being combined with widening the general purpose lanes between Duke Street and Edsel Road, that's also funded as part of this overall program. So our project scope is to expand the existing two-lane reversible HOV system to make it be three lanes between where the lanes end today up to the vicinity of Eads. We do go just north of Eads. We are looking at providing improved connections at Eads Street. The project also includes some circulation improvements on the Pentagon reservation itself, which are where buses and HOV vehicles are exchanging, and there's a lot of transit activity on that site. Also, a big part of the project is installing all the signage and tolling system that goes along with that project. The sound walls I mentioned are about 20 to 25% of the total construction cost as currently envisioned. This just shows on the top there is the system today, two travel lanes with two shoulders. You have the old metal style guardrail. The bottom section shows the three lanes. We'll have a shoulder, a wide shoulder on the right side as you head into DC. One safety feature that will be an improvement is concrete barrier separating all these systems instead of the old guardrail that we have up there today. Access is remaining just as it is today. The HOV ramps that are there today will convert to hot ramps. So you can still, you would access the facility exactly like you do today. There just will be ramps there and our guidance in terms of tolling if you don't meet the HOV 3 requirements. Similar to our other systems, I would just mention that current vehicles that have the hybrid exemption, that does go away with this system. They can still use the system, but they need to pay a toll. The one ramp that will not convert is the brand new ramp at Seminary Road. That's been a commitment, and it's been designated as HOV transit at all times, and that's remaining as an HOV ramp at all times in the future as well.
Let me ask you a question quickly during this. But there's also currently an entry access point at Seminary Road onto the express lanes.
Yes.
And then, so as I understand this, within Alexandria, the only two access points are Seminary Road and right off of Quaker Lane. Correct?
Correct. Wherever you access today to the HOV system is where you would access in the future. There's no planned changes to that at this time and with this project. This just is a diagram that shows some of the improvements that are being made at Eads Street. The basic roadway network that's there today will stay exactly as it is, but what we're going to be doing is extending the reversible nature of the system farther to the north. And so today, the ramps at the, is there a pointer person? So the ramp at the top there, that ramp is currently stays southbound all the time. In our concept, that will become reversible, and so vehicles in the morning, buses, anybody that wants carpoolers that want to go into the Pentagon to either drop passengers off, they will be able to go over to the left. And then people that want to go to Pentagon City and point south, they will head to the right. And right now, all of that traffic is all coming down that one ramp that's on the south side of 395, or east side, I guess, of 395 here. In the PM direction, that would just reverse. The same thing in terms of the circulation. So this is one of the big benefits in terms of making bus travel more reliable. Today, traffic stacks up as it approaches this intersection and interchange as people are all trying to get over to the Pentagon or to points in Pentagon City. This just shows some of the improvements that are being made on the Pentagon reservation itself. You see that green loopy thing. There's also four traffic signals that are being added. They will be timed as a system and managed and maintained by Arlington County. That will help bus flow in and out of the Pentagon reservation. There's also, with this, there'll be a loop for drop-off for carpoolers, our informal or slugger carpools. That's a pretty healthy transit environment in that area. And this was also funded, $10 million set aside in that Atlantic Gateway grant for improvements. And this was something that already the Pentagon had worked on. They had a master plan that had already been improved. They just had not really figured out how to implement, so we're kind of helping them get started with their overall plan, and this fits in with that. Amanda's been leading that effort along with our key stakeholders. We've worked with, you know, Arlington County as well as others to try to get all of this worked out with the Pentagon. This talks about our roles and responsibilities. 95 Express or Transurban is responsible for doing the preliminary engineering and the design. They've been working collaboratively with us, so the plans that we present at the public hearing are ones that they have developed with us. They've been doing cost estimating, which we have also been doing. They're coming up with a finance plan. We're also doing independent finance plan ourselves. They are working on procuring a design build contractor to deliver this project. You might recall from 95 Express, they were partnered with Floor Lane, and it was kind of a sole source negotiation that we did with that project. They have three shortlisted design build teams that are very familiar to BDOT. They've delivered design build projects for us. And they're working with us. We're also involved in that process, providing guidance and concurring as they move along through that process. But the good thing is this means that we'll get a competitively bid project. They should have pricing in December. It will be combined with a technical score. It's a 30-70% mix, which is very typical of what we do. And then they've been going out with us to community and public outreach. We've been meeting with homeowners associations and others. So we've done that jointly together. In fact, they're out tonight at an Arlington down in Crystal City at a community with one of our team members. So we typically are going together. The one thing I would say about this, and talk a little bit in the schedule, but in the secretary, recently sent a letter to the local jurisdiction, South Sandia, Arlington, that committed to a minimum transit payment, annual transit payment of $15 million, which would come out of this finance plan. And so that has been conveyed to our partner, Transurban. We are still negotiating with them. There's a lot of, you know, nitty-gritty detail about, you know, what the costs are, what the revenue lines are. All of that is still ongoing as we work to finalize what we call our final proposal requirements. We will give those to them on October 3rd. That's our deadline to provide them. And then they will have 120 days to give us a final proposal that meets those guidelines. So included in those guidelines would be a $15 million transit payment, among other things. In that letter that came from the secretary, it was also indicated that if the proposal doesn't come back meeting our requirements, that the department would consider other project delivery options, including doing our own design build project or doing a separate P3 project, separate and apart from Transurban. But we still are working on this. We feel like in terms of the you know, our best shot at getting a decent finance plan, given the fact that they're already in the corridor, they're already operating the gates, is to take advantage of the efficiencies that they have already to get the best price. So we're working very hard to have a successful negotiation of that.
And if I may interrupt, the attachment in your packet is that letter, attachment two, so you have to all have a copy of that.
Okay, I'm going to let Amanda walk through the
question. Sure. So we've recently completed an environmental assessment in its draft form. We made it available to the public on our website September 12th, so you can go and download that report as well as all the technical studies supporting our findings. The actual hard copies are going to be made available at Beatley Library here for review, and then we're also putting them at the Arlington Government Center, and we always have it at VDOT's offices should somebody want to come over there and take a look at a hard copy form. If you want to go to the next slide, I just want to get into some of our findings. You know, the largest finding here is the noise impacts that we realized as part of this project and doing the analysis. And one thing I want to say about this, you'll see that we have 8.1 miles of noise walls proposed to mitigate the noise impact along the corridor. Without this project, these communities meet the requirement of noise mitigation already, without us even doing this project, adding a lane. This is a corridor that predated the noise policy for the department, and already many of the properties are experiencing greater than 65 decibel noise impacts along the corridor, and that's our threshold for noise mitigation. And in order to get a wall, we need to be able to insert a wall and reduce that noise by greater than 6 decibels. So 8.1 miles of proposed walls. And if you go to the next slide, it gets very specific of where they're proposed. Now, quickly, I want to touch upon the red wall that you see on the west side of 395. That wall is actually associated with the Duke to Etzel widening of the general purpose lanes. It will be constructed as part of this project. And we do have a slide later on that just gives some highlights of that particular project we're delivering. Then the green walls are the walls that are feasible and reasonable as part of this project. I wanted to highlight and bring your attention to obviously the wall south of Seminary. As many of you may have recalled, that wall was actually voted down by the community at the time that we did the ramp at the Mark Center there. The reason the wall is back on the table is because we're back with another capacity improvement with federal dollars, and so they get another bite at the apple. If they want it now, they can certainly vote it in. If they choose to not have it, they can certainly vote it out, and I'll walk you through that voting process. So that is, this slide is probably a very important slide for the Alexandria folks, because you can see where the walls are within your communities. And then during the process, this is a draft noise report. The design builder would then do a final design noise report to get a little bit more exact about the height and the placement. Right now in our report, you'll see ranges of heights along the corridor where the walls are proposed. If you go to the next slide, this is a continuation of the study all the way up to the bend at E Street as you approach there, and you can see again clearly that there are long stretches of noise walls proposed along this corridor. The golf course on the east side of the corridor, Army Navy qualify their open recreation space, and they qualify for noise mitigation if they choose to have the wall as part of our impact. So let me just talk about the noise process and to remind you all how that works. Essentially, you need to be an impacted property, an impacted receptor, to qualify for a vote. If you have a wall that, and you have to be able to be mitigated. So if you have a wall that mitigates your noise and you benefit from that mitigation within our study area, you get a vote on whether or not you want the wall constructed. So we send a certified mail ballot. We follow up with regular mail just to make sure we have a good capture. Based on that response, we take a majority rules, and then that's how we decide who gets, if the wall goes or if the wall does not go. So let me paint this scenario for you. There are 20 benefited receptors based on a wall. Out of the 20 benefited receptors, 9 people respond. 11 people just don't even respond to our ballot. So out of the 9 people, if 5 people out of those 9 people want the wall, we're building the wall. So you know, the 11 people might have had an opinion that they just never responded. So just that's a, one thing that we were very adamant about when we got into the public, to make sure that, you know, neighbors that want these walls or don't want these walls just understand the process in which to get people to respond. We let renters also vote, although they are not weighted as equally as an owner. And sometimes owners aren't even in the area, could care less, you know, they, we never hear from them, but at least it gives the renter, long-term renters, a chance to vote on whether they want the wall as well. So that is our process in a nutshell. We say the walls have to be feasible. That means they can actually be constructed from an engineering perspective, and then reasonable. And there's three prongs to that reasonableness. There's cost. That means one receptor. We would not build greater than 1,600 square foot of wall to protect that receptor. So that's cost feasibleness. It needs to be that's cost reasonableness. It needs to be reasonable as though it actually attenuates noise and reduces it greater than 6 decibels. And then the other prong is the voting process. It needs to be reasonable because it's reasonable to the public and they actually want the wall. Army Navy Country Club, there'll be one vote. They're one property owner, they have a wall, just like Winkler was when we did the seminary ramp. So if you go to the next slide, all of our studies, such as air and noise, are supported by our traffic analysis. This is just to show you the difference between the person group, but not vehicles, but the, how many people the general purpose lanes carry compared to the HOV lanes, and then the HOV lanes in the future with or without the project. So you can see that obviously with the project we are carrying more people. That's also due to the fact that we are actually are adding a lane, so we are adding capacity. And you can see the stagnant growth of general purpose lanes because essentially there's no ability for those lanes to grow. However, what we do see in the model is that capacity along the general purpose lanes are freeing up, but they're being, it's being immediately replaced by lane demand that's actually on your arterial network. So the good news takeaway from adding the capacity to this corridor and the hot lane conversion is not only does it incentivize more people to carpool throughout here, but you also get the ability to free up some more space in your general purpose lane, so it discourages the, you know, the diversion of people maybe cutting through and not wanting to be on the interstate. And that's the AM peak period.
Yeah, a question. I would assume that since you're moving more people through that, a portion of that is due to more transit moving people.
Well, actually, that's the beauty of this slide compared to what Tim's going to talk to you about, because it does not even take into account the program that him and his team have been working on. So we would expect to, whatever program gets delivered with the funding that we're dedicating as part of this project, you should see greater numbers than we have here. This is just a the transit that we have within the corridor today that's accounted for in the model, as well as the HOV and carpool community. So the program that DRPT is working on will be on top of the person group.
Okay. So this is just for the current transit systems that are
using. That's correct.
Okay.
So I think that's another good news.
This is 3 hours
of
numbers.
Carpooling?
This is 3 hours. This corresponds to the HOV period.
This would be current rates of carpooling, for instance.
Yes, and then we do grow that, and then we also take into account when we convert it to hot and we introduce travel choices to anyone in a car, mm-hmm. how many people would actually convert from, being a hot lane user. So you could be a single occupancy driver now that otherwise would have been pinched off that facility and you want to convert and pay the toll. Mm-hmm. You could be a single occupancy driver that now says, wow, those lanes are managed and they're moving good, so I really want to be an HOV person now, so I don't have to pay, and there's more of an incentive for me to carpool because we have better management of those lanes. And everyone that drives this corridor, you know that even our HOV lanes get a little dicey with the demand that they get in the morning.
Is the anticipation that there would be an equal amount of participation in HOV in the future when it's HOT, or that it would drop, because there have to be three now, right? It goes up.
Right. Well, it does go up, and but also remember that we're extending hours beyond what you experienced today. For you have this HOV restriction today. Now we have a 24/7 hotlink facility, mm-hmm. and the phenomena that we see is that we have a lot longer periods of HOV because there's a 24/7 incentive to be HOV. Mm-hmm. There's not today because you could just miss the period and then get in your car by yourself and then get on. So conversely, if you go to the next page, Carrie, in the southbound and through my work at the Pentagon, what they see, the slug lines at the Pentagon extend way into like 8 o'clock now and 8:30 because people can work longer, but the incentive is they can get on those lanes and then they don't have to pay once they hit the Beltway and they take the express down if they're south of the Beltway. So having the express lane system and the actual toll will incentivize people to carpool, and it just kind of spreads out that demand a little further. So that's another nice benefit where you're actually spreading out the demand by extending those hours with the express lane system. But again, we see an increase overall in moving more people substantially in the southbound period as well.
That question, currently, single occupancy vehicles can get on the HOV lanes at ease, and legally, you're not in violation of the HOV at that point.
You are in violation of it, but it's been very difficult for us to enforce it because our state police would then have to go all the way into D.C. and turn around. We don't have like a U-turn spot at the bridge.
But then how about that slip lane from the off to the left?
Let me describe that. So that's called Ramp G, and that's the slip ramp from the GP lanes into the hot lanes. We are actually, there will be a toll point north of Eads. So currently, if you're on Eads Street, there is an access ramp that goes right into the hot lanes. That will be a completely tolled movement in the future. If you want to be in the general purpose lanes and avoid the toll, you would have to find another way into the GP lanes if you were accessing that system from that point, like Long Bridge or however you want to get there. If you're on the general purpose lanes, we studied two things. We studied just tolling Ramp G. We have Ramp G is kind of where, you know, everyone redistributes themselves based on whatever they feel is like the shorter, quickest moving line. And yes, it is very violated in the morning, but we, through a CTV action, will have to get the entire system, including to the river, because it's in our, you know, previous designation of HOV, that it's to the river, that it's an HOV system.
So the G lane ramp will also be tolled?
It will be tolled, but because it will be a northern toll point. You would know what that toll amount was as you approach that ramp. You wouldn't necessarily be tolled for that ramp, but to get into that center lane and go the last mile and a half to the bridge, that would be a tolled movement. So we are definitely seeing, based on that travel choice and definitely a betterment of the transit moving into the district and making that final trip, because a lot of people come and circulate the Pentagon and then keep on going into DC, that it just really moves transit a lot quicker. So not only is it encouraging the HOV usage, but it's giving a big benefit to the transit riders in the area that are making that choice already to be on transit, and they're not sitting in that queue anymore. So.
Do you have any idea at this point what cost would be? And I'm assuming it would be flexible depending on the volume of traffic. If there's more volume, it will more volume in the GP lanes, it would cost more to be in the hot lane, correct? Isn't that how they normally
do it? Not necessarily, and there we have experienced that. I don't know if we kind of experienced that today on the Beltway, because we did take the express lanes due to an accident. It's extremely high. And it just depends. I mean, Transurban manages their lanes. So, for example, going south, where we have the fix that we're doing currently with the Garrisonville, when they end, every express lane ends somewhere. We end at Garrisonville, and there's a weave issue there that we are extending about 2.5 miles and smoothing out. What Transurban did when that became a big choke point at Garrisonville is that they kept increasing the toll to discourage people from being, you know, they're trying to price people out. That's what they say. We want to keep raising the price to a tolerance level to price people out. But what people are thinking is, if that toll is $20, the general purpose lanes must be terrible, so I better stay here and just pay the $20 or I'm never going to get home. And people wouldn't leave. So what Transurban ended up doing through a lot of outreach is saying, that's not what we're trying to do here, people. And then they started putting up advanced signs saying, this is our toll price, there's major congestion ahead, you know, make a decision here what you want to do. And it got better. It got better. So I would say we are not putting out toll prices. I mean, obviously that's up to Transurban, how they're managing their lanes. We don't have that available, but that situation where you're describing is, you know, it's very, very high. It doesn't mean it's because, you know, something is terribly wrong in the general purpose lane. Sometimes it's very, very high because they're trying to keep their lanes managed and price people from even being in them. Mm-hmm. And there's a certain tolerance that anyone's going to pay. I might pay a toll, but I might not be willing to pay a $5 toll.
Right, but see, that's where I'm heading. And I don't know if this is the appropriate time to even raise it, but the two entry points in the city of Alexandria are at Seminary and Quaker Lane, and that we call that sometimes Center City, and we are suffering a lot already now from a lot of cut-through traffic that's affecting through where Councilman John Chapman lives, which is West Taylor Run, all the way through to 395, and we're seeing major amounts of cut-through traffic where people are getting off of 95, coming off Telegraph, Duke, Quaker, Seminary, Quaker Lane, just avoiding all the way down to Springfield and then up 395. So they're using us to cut through, and then they're hopping back on, where rather than using the express lanes to get off at Tyson's, they're cutting through, and then they're taking Seminary all the way through to Route 7 and going straight out to Tyson's. And my concern is that the hot lanes will incentivize even more cut-through traffic through Center City. It's my concern. And also, I had a hope that maybe City of Alexandria would have some input and maybe some net revenue from, you know, if we had input into what those entry, you know, you get on a Seminary Road, it's going to cost you $10, $15. That would disincentivize single-occupancy vehicles. As opposed to if it was $5, I would hop on a Seminary Road if I had to pay $5 for a straight shoot into D.C. You know, so I was hoping, but it sounds like the City of Alexandria would have no input or into that. So that would just be solely TransUnion and what TransUnion decides.
They're the operators of the facility, and the scenario that you're describing, we hear often when we're introducing these hot lanes throughout the network that Susan showed you earlier. We did a similar study for a concerned community along 495 when we built that system, and because 495 became so attractive once we had the express lane systems in, because it really shifted people that would otherwise be in the general purpose lanes onto the express lanes, and then, you know, move the general purpose lanes. We actually saw traffic coming off of the express lanes, coming off the arterials and onto the interstate, because driver behavior and expectation is people rather be on the interstate than an arterial, hands down, over being on a side street. There's just a lot more driver expectation on an interstate for what's perceived as cut-through traffic, and there's also that reliability and predictability to do that. So the area in the general purpose lanes that we're freezing up, we see it being absorbed again by the traffic that you're describing.
Right, and we've looked at that on both 95 and on 495, and we've seen a reduction in the arterial road network around there. So, you know, some of the people that are doing the cut-through now, it's because they don't even have the choice to be on the HOV lanes, and they're avoiding the congestion in the GP lanes. So they will now have a choice to pay, you know, where they just don't even have that choice, but, and they're not willing to sit in traffic.
But the community I'm talking about, or that group of cars I'm talking about, are the cars that there still is nothing getting them straight down 95 to 395 and then to Tyson's. I mean, there's no hot lane on 95 zipping them along to the intersection of 395 or 95 through to Tyson's, so for 495 through to Tyson's. So I don't see that stopping the existing cut through that's occurring.
It won't solve everything.
Well, I mean, I don't see a decrease in it.
Incremental, this is not your, what was your C change that you were looking for in the game changer? This is, it's a definite improvement. We're seeing that. We did look at, in the traffic modeling, looked at 55 different intersections around the corner. So, you know, it is something that we look to try to see, and we are seeing improvement, not further degradation.
That's right, we are.
But not for this specific situation I'm describing, which is affecting, Mr. Chapman isn't here, but he could attest to a lot of misery that's occurring in the neighborhoods because of this cut-through traffic, and which would not be alleviated by your solution. And then since the only entry points are on Seminary Road and Quaker Lane, which are in that area that's already suffering, I mean, it's a very rich area too, frankly, and there's going to be a lot of people who are going to be incentivized to just hop on and get in those hot lanes and pay that extra toll, because there's a lot of money floating around in that area as well. So VDOT is going to have to provide better information than saying, "Oh, our studies say it's going to improve," because I don't see how it's going to improve for Center City Alexandria. I think it's going to hurt us.
Let me go keep going through the traffic slides.
A question right along with that. Mm-hmm. Is there some kind of a system set up where when the city sees a problem, as Christine mentioned, that we can come to Transurban and say, "Look, you know, since you put these in, mm-hmm. this has really gotten worse. Can we work with them to say, okay, how are you going to fix that? Maybe it's a pricing thing. I don't know. But is there a method to do that, or they?
I mean, certainly VDOT has a monthly meeting with Transurban about the operations of the entire system. So if these are things that pop up through, you know, if Jan or somebody came and approached us
about, we'd have to go through VDOT
we would coordinate with Transurban and talk about these issues. I mean, absolutely, we go through that process with them. So we have a vehicle to always be in constant communication with them. They operate the HOV gates right now as our operator since they took over the 95 express lane. So they are a partner, a regional partner.
Okay.
One other thing, as a corridor, I just wanted to highlight, we also looked at travel times along the corridor. This is just the general purpose lanes during the morning. You'll see the bar charts for existing, and it's also compared to the 2040 no build and then the 2040 build. So compared to what, 100% worse traffic or 72% worse traffic, as you indicated before. But what it's showing you is overall, building this project on average decreases travel time in the general purpose lanes by 6 minutes. Like Susan said, not setting the world on fire, but we are trying to at least sustain with this region that's continually growing. We're trying to sustain or improve, and we have an incremental improvement here very far out in the future to a 2040. So if you go to the PM, we see a similar trend. One thing I wanted to highlight too, when you talk about time savings, that distribution of traffic, the way we reconfigure the operations of these, huge contributor to that. You don't have people stacking up on the express lanes in the morning and then, you know, choking out everyone else trying to continue on into DC. We've got everyone kind of situated on their respective ramp wherever they want to go in Pentagon or Pentagon City, and really alleviating that. And it makes it a lot better for those transit providers that I'm a bus, I'm sitting in a queue because I'm jammed up because of one ramp. So in the southbound, again, coming back at the reverse in the evening commute, we actually are seeing a little bit higher travel time decrease in there, but on average, 15% reduction in the AM and the PM. So this is getting at, you know, looking at the arterials leading up to the interstate and how that's behaving, and kind of the comments the discussion we just had about the behavior of some of these intersections. This is AM peak hour level of service. I threw this in as like an example. I want to also note that tomorrow we have a in-depth traffic meeting to really go into the model links with the local jurisdictions. Alexandria is a participant in that tomorrow over at our district, to get into like the weeds about it. But this just shows you that with the project, built in 2040, we actually see a 91% increase in level of service at intersections during the peak hour. So we're able, and that's a great thing. We're actually reducing and eliminating entirely the 2% of the failing intersections that we have in the no-build condition. But going from 80% to 91% for those intersections is a big benefit for our area, and it's a safety benefit as well. This is a capture of all the project benefits related to traffic. You see the 50% increase in volume, moving more than 13,000 more people in the PMP north of Leeds. That's kind of a highlight point. And again, that's not with what Tim has going on with his transit study he's going to talk to you about. It hits the congestion highlights and really the expanding travel choices. Susan talked about this, but you know, incentivizing HOV throughout the day and not really off-peak. There's no incentive to be HOV off-peak now. And then allowing the motors to continue north to the hot lanes, the Turkey Pops, so they're not just all merging out of the express lanes there and choking up traffic. I was part of that on my way to Pentagon this morning. That was fun. And then the reliability, just knowing that, you know, if that's the day you need to get somewhere, you have this reliable network in the center that's being managed, the lanes are being managed, you can get there. One of our biggest safety improvements, I didn't highlight in the operational piece, but the southbound slip ramp, when you head south on 395 from East Street, there is one last slip ramp that allows you to hop into those general purpose lanes before just the entire HOV system. If you're familiar, we're actually removing that ramp and closing it off. The last time you can do that is actually north of East Street. When you come out of DC, you have to slip off the ramp into the general purpose lanes there. We don't have a toll point, obviously, coming into Virginia. You would have to slip off the ramp there and then continue on the express lanes if you choose to pay the toll. That ramp with all the slip ramps so close together there, we're eliminating a ramp that is contributing to about 31% of the crashes in the corridor right at that ramp. So that's a big safety improvement that we're introducing as well.
Okay, thank you, Amanda. Question about
noise barriers.
Yes.
Do you take into consideration noise barriers such as what's on the Wilson Bridge? Because I find those extremely effective if you've ever walked along there, biked along there, where the noise barriers are, and then they're gone. The difference is significant. So I just wondered if the homeowners...
Like aesthetics, you mean, and materials?
Aesthetics is I think it's better looking at the sky than a piece of concrete.
Sure.
But the effectiveness is significant as far as how it works.
So you're talking about the clear,
yeah,
the clear ones.
Yeah, I just wondered if that was one of the options that they're looking at in the future.
Well, that also will be coordinated with the folks that actually vote on the wall. But there's a couple things to highlight about the clear walls. They are reflective when it comes to noise. When we build the concrete walls, the highway side has an absorption treatment on it. The clear ones do not. Noise bounces from those. So if we would introduce that, if somebody wanted that, we would have to evaluate what that would do to the other side of the roadway. But not that we're, not want to consider them at all. We clearly put them on, no pun intended, clearly, but we put them on the Woodrow Wilson. But
okay.
That would be done probably during final noise design.
Okay. Okay. Great. Thanks, Amanda. And as Susan and I think Carrie said, my name is Tim Rosegroom. I'm with the Department of Rail and Public Transportation. I'm standing in for Todd Worsley today, so that's why I had the Todd name tag. We didn't get the presentation updated in time. So, and just for those of you that aren't familiar with DRPT, we are... the state agency, or the Department of Rail and Public Transportation, we exist under the authority of the Commonwealth Transportation Board. We're a sister agency to VDOT, and we fund the Amtrak service that exists in the state. We provide the state share for the local bus systems, DASH, as well as Metro, and state share of the capital funding for those systems as well. So when this project was announced back in November or December of last year, the secretary asked DRPT to conduct a transit and TDM study in parallel with the VDOT project, and we looked at all of the jurisdictions all along the full length of the express lane. So that's the cities of Alexandria and Fredericksburg at the south end. That's Arlington County, Fairfax County, Prince William County going north to south, Stafford County and Spotsylvania County. And then the two commissions, NVTC, which Mr. Levine sits on, and PRTC, and then finally the two major rail operators in the corridor, BRE and Metro. So that's everyone who's part of the study. And then what we're actually doing with the study is going through and developing basically a exhaustive list, not quite as exhaustive as the COG, a TPV list, but of an exhaustive list of potential projects, and those can include things like local bus service, increases to DASH service routes that are already there. That can include new routes that haven't been contemplated yet, new commuter services. The picture on the slide is a PRTC bus that's coming from Prince William County. It can include transit capital projects, transit centers. It can include rail projects. I know the Potomac Yard Metro is a major, rail capital project in the corridor. Park and ride lots, those are very popular when you get to the further southern jurisdictions. Prince William County, Stafford County has a major need for park and ride lots. Transportation demand management, that's what TDM stands for. So that's programs to encourage carpooling, vanpooling, telework, basically anything that sort of avoids someone from taking a car trip to work. And then finally, technology that would support all of those services. I think Susan already mentioned the commitment of the Commonwealth of $15 million, and that was in a letter that's been distributed, that went to Mayor Silverberg and has been distributed. But that is a commitment of the Commonwealth. It would be an annual payment that would go to fund these type of projects.
Let me ask a question about that, since I've heard that number thrown around a lot. Mm-hmm. Is that $15 million to who? All the affected jurisdictions, or is it?
Yeah,
that's Spotsylvania all the way through to North Arlington?
Yes, I would say the exact mechanism of how projects would get submitted, how projects would get rated, how the revenue would be distributed, that is to be worked out. But it does include the entire length of the corridor.
So yes. Although we in the city of Alexandria have two access points, and would be pretty much your primary feeder. Mm-hmm. We have to split the pot with everyone else equally.
So it would.
Shouldn't we be getting most of it?
We benefit from VRE going out.
Right.
It gets people off the highway.
Except we have the two access points in the city of Alexandria. We have two of the four access points along the whole corridor?
Right.
So wouldn't we be experiencing the most impact in terms of access points?
I would say that it's to get to that amount, it's most likely that we're going to have to combine as one project. So it's really looking at the revenue stream on both 95 all the way from Stafford all the way. This project, if you only took the revenue from, Turkey Cock to DC, it would be very difficult to support that, we think. We're still in very early discussions, like I said. Mm-hmm. So that's also still to be worked out. So really, I don't know that you could definitely say that's the case. This is the mechanism for how we're getting that, funding amount set. Mm-hmm. But we haven't really figured out all the financial deal about, where it's actually coming from in terms of the tolling and all of that.
And if it's worth repeating, because, it's helpful to hear it again, if it's Stafford County gets $1 million, it needs to be a transit service mm-hmm. that touches this corridor. It's not $1 million to go to Tyson's Corner.
Right.
It's $1 million because you actually go through the 395 corridor. So there is a regional string attached to that directly benefits people living in this region because it has to be a transit service that runs this stretch.
Okay, but then I think I was discussing before this with someone about that that's a very fluid mm-hmm. analysis to begin with, because there were proposals for Old Town that were strung to the corridor. So there seems to be a lot of fluidity in terms of where this income stream can be used. It seems like anywhere in the city of Alexandria could be used if you do that analysis, right?
So I would say that's a fair statement. I would say, I'm going to actually tell them a little bit later and sort of go through the mechanism of, you know, how the scoring and how the evaluation will occur. But to your point, you know, the study area that we've been asked to look at is a broader corridor. It encompasses parallel modes, parallel routes to I-395 and I-95. It does encompass VRE service, as Mr. Levain mentioned. It does encompass metro service. It does encompass major arterials, Route 1 and Fairfax County or Richmond Highway. And at the time that we were asked to conduct this study, you know, the secretary did ask us to look at the full length into Stafford County. At the time, actually, it was only a 2-mile extension of the express lanes were contemplated. And now, since the Commonwealth's been awarded the Atlantic Gateway funding, we're now looking at a 10-mile extension of the express lanes all the way to the Fredericksburg limit. But we do have a broad definition of sort of what the corridor is, both the length and the width of the corridor, and that's right. Represented on the map.
I mean, it's just $15 million sounds like a great sum, but sure. You know, when you really start looking at it, I mean, the carrot you're holding out for the city of Alexandria isn't that big. Mm-hmm. And my point is, we have two access points.
But the point that you have to realize, too, is that the express bus is coming from Stafford on those lanes, an increased VRE service, that's taking people off the general purpose lanes, and that's to our benefit. Mm-hmm. So it's not just our transit service, it's convincing more and more of everybody in the corridor to take transit.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's we're the beneficiaries of those transit systems further out.
Mm-hmm. It'll be interesting to see how that allocation.
It was you know, to be determined.
It's a minimum.
So it is a minimum. We'll get, you know, exactly, it would grow with time, you know, exactly the mechanism, I think, is also, you know, it's just to be determined.
Inflation adjustment should be in there.
Okay, I got a question for staff. And so the funding that would evolve from this, would that go directly into CIP?
We would need to apply for the funding, similar to do with other grants with the state. We would actually apply to receive the toll revenue for projects that were eligible. And there's a list of projects that, sort of the draft list that the
Correct.
State has asked us to put together,
yes.
basically from the long range plan and from all our transportation plans of projects. And so based on what the state determines as the eligible criteria, our projects would be rated against that, and we would apply like we do with other grants.
So not necessarily if we would have an allocation, say we get, of that 15 million, let's just say we get a million, we wouldn't just get the million, we would apply for grants for whatever programs that might get a million or maybe more.
So an eligible program would be, or project would be the West End Transway.
Right.
That would be, because it's on the corridor, it's
okay.
going to be in those lanes.
Mm-hmm. It's a little more convoluted than I thought. But
so we would apply for that.
Maybe we could come out a little ahead that way if we had a program that was more worthy than Arlington and the rest of the country.
Yeah, I mean, I would say generally, and again, I'm sort of speculating, but it likely would be an application-based program.
Okay.
The I-66 program that MBTC funds works that way. And I also say this, that we've worked with some of the other regional entities to sort of say that if a project could receive MBTA funding, for example, it could also receive this type of funding. We wouldn't want you know, this pot of projects to be limited only to toll funding. There's it's not called Smart Scale, but it was HB2. DRPT has other capital
right.
programs, you know, that can match funding. So, you know, this would be in the mix of other types of funding. And yeah, it would likely be an application based
okay.
program. So, and I'll step very quickly through it. We can step to the next slides. I think we've covered this. So this is just a list of all the transit providers that are in the corridor. I think every jurisdiction through the corridor does have a local transit system. In Stafford County, they have a private bus operator. And then Fredericksburg has a local transit system that feeds the VRE, and of course VRE and Amtrak operate within the corridor. So those are all, you know, the type of transit systems or transit systems that do exist today, and you know, could be receiving funding and running service based on this. And the next one, I am going to ask Tom Harrington, who's the project manager for Cambridge Systematics, to come up and explain this slide. So,
all right, so what we've been doing is working with the jurisdictional key stakeholder group in assembling the list, and as Tim mentioned, it's service improvements, it's capital improvements. We have commuter bus, we have BRT local bus, and rail station improvements. Given that there's some uncertainty both about not only the stream from the toll revenue, but even other funding sources and really a whole investment strategy, we started by grouping them into these scenarios, low, medium, and high, sort of testing packages of projects to see what type of benefits we get. We're using the regional travel demand model and testing projects. But some of the evaluation measures that we're looking at include sort of overall the impact on the corridor in terms of mode share and transit trips. But then for some of these projects, what's the ridership potential of the project? How does it contribute to person throughput? Is it helping give accessibility to some of the key activity centers and job centers in the corridor? And then how does it serve in terms of equity? How does it serve disadvantaged populations, low-income folks, that sort of thing? And then we also, in addition to testing transit, had a TDM evaluation as well. So I guess we just have the one. What's on?
We have actually got a hard copy here of the omitted slides.
So just to kind of give a highlight, I just wanted, rather than talk in total generalities about types of project, about some examples of some of the things in the quarter. Actually, first slide is more just some basics on how important transit and TDM is to the corridor. So in a typical morning peak period, you've got 65,000 persons traveling northbound and 40,000 vehicles. So again, this is one of the real success stories, not just in the region, but nationally in terms of transit and TDM use. 54% of the person trips are on the HOV lanes currently. Transit vehicles are less than 1% of the vehicles, but carry 12% of the people, basically. And you know, the bar chart's kind of showing breakdown non-HV and HV. And this is from work MWCOG did in terms of counting trips that leave the road from those things. But the second thing was just to highlight a few of the Alexandria projects. So we have some improvements to DASH services, some DASH bus routes in the corridor. We have some of the DASH circulators that are in your plan. Bus rapid transit, we have the West End Transitway and the Duke Street Transitway on the list. Then King Street and Van Dorn Street Metro improvements, and those include things like bus bays at stations. The Potomac Yard Metro Rail Station is on the list. New expanded transit centers at Landmark Mall and Mark Center, and then DASH Bus Garage, which you probably need if you're going to expand all the bus servers. So, as I understand, these are projects that have been on your list, have been in your plan, and really what we're doing is starting with this comprehensive list of what are the improvements that sort of meet our definition of being in the corridor, and then we're evaluating them all. We'll have kind of the costs and benefits of all these things laid out. At that point, decisions will have to be made about which projects sort of advance, you know, using a variety of different funding sources. So I'll add on part of it.
Okay, this just is the overall project schedule. You can see we've been working on public outreach and putting plans together in terms of the environmental assessment. The green are for the transit people. They started their study in April officially, kicked it off officially, and then they're wrapping up in December. We did have public information meetings in the spring, and then we'll have our public hearings here October 24th in Arlington, and then the 26th in Alexandria. We also have one on the 27th for the Duke to Edsel Street widening, or Duke Street to Edsel Road widening project. And then this will be considered as part of the overall approval of the long-range plan. in October, November timeframe. We expect our final decision on our environmental document in December. And then you want to flip to the, this just talks a little bit about the Duke Street to Edsel Road widening. We are coming back out to the public for a final public hearing. We did adjust some of the design with that project, and so that's why we're coming back out, even though we did have the public hearing last spring, and that'll be on the 27th. And what we'll have at all of these public, the three public hearings, both projects will be, and comment sheets will be there, so that if people want to, you know, they show up at the wrong night or they wanted to comment on both projects, they'll be able to do that. And this just lists the dates, times. This is on our website, and we do have a web page, as does Transurban through 395 Express website, and they're both linked to each other. So there's lots of project information out there, our traffic report, our environmental documents, as well as other information about the project.
This is a great bullet here. Transit vehicles are less than 1% of the vehicles, yeah, but carry 12% of trips.
I saw that.
It makes me think if it was 3% of vehicles, it could carry 30% of trips.
Then we wouldn't need
like
HOT, yeah, right? We'd just have everyone in transit.
You know, I think it's about giving people choices. You know, there is a limit to how many people will get on the bus. You can provide as many as you want, but there's, you know, some people just that are going to ride in their single occupant vehicle no matter what you do. You know, we're trying to encourage people, and some of it's because people just don't have the choice to do otherwise, you know, because whatever their life situation is. So I think the idea is to provide as many choices as possible and as much encouragement as possible to get people into transit vehicles. And I think, you know, this will give the opportunity to improve that.
So. I think people may remember there was something years ago, an earlier version of this, where there's a nice big promise of expectation of transit funding, and then all of a sudden that funding was just gone.
Right.
And so this time, both the NBTC and the Transportation Planning Board, we're going to have this locked in, or it's not going to, the project is not going to go on to the CLRP. And so right, this is like a binding commitment we're talking about. I mean, this is a firm commitment, the 15 plus that, right? It's a different kind of contractual arrangement that we have this time. So.
Oh, what's the anticipated revenue from this project that the toll provider will be receiving annually?
We're still having discussions about what that might look like, I would say. And so there's really nothing, you know, that I can share right now. We have revenue lines we're working with, they have revenue lines they're working with. We're also having somebody do what we call a level two investment grade traffic and revenue study. So that's happening as well, which will give us better information. So, you know, so much of it depends on, you know, many different, you know, factors in terms of what is available. But we're working on a number of fronts to have discussions with Transurban. Typically, you know, their operation and maintenance costs come off first. So there's lots of discussion about what those numbers should be and what should get baked into the initial financial model, as well as the initial construction costs, all of that. You know, so we're negotiating on multiple fronts, I would say, on all of those items.
Yeah, on the funding issue there, is basically Transurban is taking out loans to do all the construction. And so their revenue coming in, most of that money coming in was going to be paying off those loans. That's, you know, it's probably a long-term loan.
Yeah.
Going at. On the other hand, they have to set a price on this that'll make it work. To get maximum revenue, there's that fine line where, you know, what are people going to pay? And if it's too low, you know, and I don't know how they do that, but I mean, they have enough experience to do that. But I can see, I mean, a lot of people say, yeah, it's worth it. But
Well, and I mean, you know, that's one thing. This region now has two systems up and running that give both.
Right.
And it's not just whatever transurban things. They've got to get their investors. They've got to get bankers. They've got to get rating agencies. Everybody, you know, has to kind of agree, you know, even the federal government, because they have a, there's a TIFIA loan process that where the federal government subsidizes a portion.
Right.
So, you know, there's a lot of different people looking at these revenue lines, and, you know, some are more conservative, some are less, you know, so there's a lot of detail and work. And it is, you know, this deal, when it was cut, was a 75-year deal originally, so that it's not the end of the concession period will stay the same even with this. So we're now looking at about 70 years because, you know, the time that's lapsed already on these. So, but it's a long time to predict what revenue will do and not.
And it's interesting to see what's in the current hot lanes. I see a lot of business vehicles. You know, they write that off as an expense because, you know, if you're paying a, you know, a crew to go out, you're not paying them to sit in traffic, so it's worth it to them to pay $20, whatever it is, to get there faster.
Right, and we've seen from 495, a very slow ramp-up period that required them to bring more equity and to refinance that deal. They are at revenue risk, and you're paying for them to take that revenue risk. So they bring equity to the deal, which they don't want to, you know, lose. So they did have to bring more money in and refinance 495 on 95. That has not been the case. You know, we already had a system in place. Everybody already knew how to use it, knew a lot about, you know, what the benefits of it were. So there was a lot of, you know, just incentive and people waiting. You know, they knew exactly how to use that corridor. And so they have not experienced that. They've gotten more revenue than what they projected in their first year. And whether that, you know, will continue.
It would be interesting to see how they do the whole computer algorithm on the pricing, on the traffic. I mean, it's ongoing, constant.
You know, I mean, and it's like how you make a decision is different than how I would. You know, you've got people that, you know, they only buy coffee at Starbucks and other people go to 7-Eleven. You know,
a good example is that a month ago I was heading south on 95 and Waze said, go to the hot lanes. And then the price was $24. And I said, $24? Yeah, I'm a very thrifty guy. And I said, $24? My wife turns to me and said, do it. So we all.
It depends on who's in the car, which decision is made. And, you know, the models just do it one way. They assess what is the value of time for people in this corridor on a business trip, on a home trip. I mean, they do have a couple of things that they factor in, but they pretty much assume, you know, it's a model.
And when I was done at the end,
yeah,
I figured,
boy,
that was $24 well spent, because the other guys weren't moving at all.
All right.
Okay. I guess no more questions for the oncoming hot lane. And that's going to be an oncoming issue.
I kind of have a comment.
Okay.
And it's just a general one, and that's that a lot of thought goes into a project of this magnitude and all these calculations and modeling to figure out the best way to put throughput of vehicles on these particular roads to get people from point A to point B. And the modeling reflects these out years, the build, no build at 2040. But if you look at that, I mean, 2040 is not that long from now. Alexandria is going to be here in 2100 and hopefully 2200. And unless we think look for the game changer approaches that are going to get people to choose not to drive, like to really try hard to not drive alone, we're not going to have room. Like, a hot lane's not going to solve the demand that we are going to generate with development, infill of people and jobs in this region, DC, Alexandria, Arlington, the outlying counties. It's not going to be solved by hot lanes. It's not going to be solved by HOV lanes. It's not going to be solved by lanes of pavement where we put single occupant vehicles across as quickly as we can. So, I guess just my response to a lot of effort that goes into projects like this is, how do we keep thinking what are the big risks we're willing to take as a community to really change people's minds about how they get around? And to make it possible across whole regional partnerships, which you really need the state for, to make it possible for the folks that are further out who don't have the same infrastructure base that we already have in Alexandria, to also make different decisions than they're making today. Because those are the ones that are hardest to switch, because they don't have a lot of options. It's a commuter bus that they might be able to join, and that's perhaps a tough sell. But we need to keep thinking further out than 2040, further out than that marginal, you know, oh, it'll be 6 minutes faster than the other potential future condition, but it's still going to be so much worse from the present day, and then 50 years down the road after that, how does this road still perform?
Yeah, fully agree. The problem we seem to be having is when we make, you know, I'm for looking at big solutions, high risk. It's just the little stuff that we can't seem to get through without a major controversy.
Right.
King Street Complete Streets project is a fine example. It's like, that's just a small project to make things better, but
right.
It was so difficult. And I've asked staff to look at, you know, can we get somebody in here to talk about those things that in 20 or 30 years can significantly change it and start working on it now? Now, some of the cities are doing this, you know. It's
right.
We've got some big problems. I mean, you just look at the congestion we have in different parts of the city.
Right.
How do we solve that? You know, how do you get people out of cars? Maybe it's, you know, what are the solutions that we don't know about?
Right.
So anyway.
Yeah, and I would just say that the transportation master plan is scheduled to be updated in fiscal year 18. The section of the master plan that we're looking at is technology and sort of how that's going to interplay in the future with transportation. And I think that kind of gets to both of your points in that as part of that analysis, we're going to need to look at things like autonomous vehicles and changing technologies with traffic signals and
also potentially how we measure level service and whether it's people throughput,
yes, so all, and TDM and all these important questions that I think we've brought up, that's going to be a really important effort to do that. And since this commission is really charged with the implementation of that plan, particularly from the financial standpoint, that's going to be a good effort, I think, for this group too. So I think that maybe kicking that off might be helpful to have some of that technology and sort of futuristic discussion as part of that plan update might be good.
Yeah, if, you know, we're not too far off of, you know, big changes. I mean, you look what Google doing in Pittsburgh with the taxi cabs and Google. I've been following that because I was involved in autonomous vehicles, you know, 20 years ago. But it's coming. You know, it's not quite here yet. London is supposed to approve autonomous vehicles for operation there. So, it's coming and people are getting on board. I mean, Google got full backing of the mayor of Pittsburgh and city council, and they're on board. And so, you know, a lot of people are screaming and saying, oh, no. But it's coming and let's see how it works. And the big thing about that I like, it's a safety aspect. It's going to save tens of thousands of lives.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was thinking, even without inventing any new technology, if you extrapolate the trends with ride sharing and, you know, Uber Pool, where you have more than one passenger in the car, as long
yep.
as they have three vehicles in the car, including the driver, they can use the HOV, HOT lanes without paying the toll. So you might see a increase in that as a viable choice. So you could have essentially slugging from your house, you know, all along that corridor. So, you know, you might end up having higher amounts of carpooling than were anticipated in the models. And my understanding is that if carpooling exceeds a certain percentage, that there's like a negotiated, you know, give back to the partner. Because it, you know, it's basically like they're not getting any revenue from those people. So
right. Yeah, I can see 10 years down the road, or even further, that you know, autonomous vehicle are going to be, you know, most of the cars sold, and so people only need two cars or three cars. You just need one car or no cars, and just say you dial up the number and you got it. I mean, I just bought a semi-autonomous vehicle, and I just love it because it drives safer than I drive. I mean, I still got a hold on the steering wheel, but it does.
It has, but, it has the emergency braking and stuff.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, the cruise control is I just love it. I mean, because I can see that it does a better job than me. And I, not that I'm a bad driver now, but I can see that in the future is, you know, I figured that's going to be my last car because I keep them for about 10 or 15 years. So by then, I'll just, I won't have a car. I'll just call up Uber and, you know, take me where I want to go. Anyway.
Mr. Chair, I wanted to make sure you had an opportunity in case any guys are probably taking off.
Yeah, just this was a follow-up on what Melissa was saying, and to the state people, which is, what is the direct benefit to the city of Alexandria other than this potential income stream sometime in the future that we may get dependent on the bidding process? What is the benefit to the city of Alexandria? And I haven't heard of any direct benefit to the city of Alexandria, and I haven't heard of any amelioration of our cut-through traffic that we're currently experiencing. I'm curious, what benefit is there to the city of Alexandria?
Do we talk about just the traffic benefit?
I mean, you know, the project is not planned to provide a direct benefit to a jurisdiction. I mean, it's a plan to provide a benefit to the traveling public on 395, and we believe the project does that. We believe it gives more travel choice. I mean, I would ask the city, you know, you would need to look at that and say, do you feel like it is? In what way would it be? But we don't look at, you know, projects that way. We're looking at serving the traveling public. It does reduce travel times. It improves transit service by providing better travel. It improves transit circulation at the Pentagon. And so to the extent, you know, your residents are using those services, I don't know. It's not to provide a specific benefit to the city.
Well, and I'll just add, I mean, Alexandria does very, very well in terms of transit, ridership. I think Western Transitway has been thrown out a couple times as probably a model type of project that could be very well in this type of system. But I just, you know, Alexandria is very well positioned to benefit and to have projects submitted that would, you know, score very well in any type of, you know, evaluation mechanism. But, you know, at this point, we don't have specific projects that have been selected or recommended. We have a long list, and Alexandria has, Carrie and Alan both, you know, have done a very good job of sort of getting good Alexandria projects to us.
Yeah, I can see the difference because Alexandria, some of the people would use the hot lanes to get on, but they wouldn't use them very long. The benefit for people that are 50 miles out, a lot more. But, you know, we look at it in our
city. A lot more money, though, right?
Well, yeah, but it would be a benefit to them. But, what Christina's point is, you know, what benefit it is to the city, to the residents. But, yeah, for those people going and using them, fine.
Well, I mean,
noise barriers.
So.
There we go. Those wouldn't go in unless you did this project, right? I mean, based on you were describing
this. You have to have this type of project. You have to add capacity. Right. You have several dollars that are qualified.
So that's an example of a local, because the existing condition is already sort of out of compliance, as it were.
In fact, I would say that it's safe to say, based on the limited footprint of this corridor, this is probably one of the last chances to get noise mitigation on the corridor. Because I do not see any other capacity improvement in my lifetime or career lifetime that would probably occur in this corridor that would trigger another noise evaluation for mitigation per our policy today.
Okay.
So I think maybe we have a lot of concerns about how best to position Alexandria to win in this project, and what we're hearing a lot from DPVA is that things aren't baked yet. So is it possible for staff to kind of keep us in the loop of when we can influence the decisions that DPVA are making, so that we're in a position as a commission to say, you know, we have two exits, we feel like we should be prioritized X, Y, and Z, like, so we can find those opportunities for us to do that? Because it sounds like we're getting the same answers for both of these, and there will be opportunities moving forward for us to have an influence.
You're talking specifically about the funding.
The whole, yeah, I mean, like, I'm sure that they'll.
Impact
this is not the last time we're going to see
this
them.
This is not the last. Yeah.
But I mean,
well,
you know,
this is the last time you're going to see this before the public hearing, which is in October.
Yeah, but I mean,
but certainly we're going to continue to update you on this process. Yes, we're going to continue. And if we have, once we find out about the application process or whatever the process is for the funding, the Transportation Commission plays a huge role.
I mean, more is that funding model is being developed.
Right, yeah.
The opportunity for us to influence that as the state is developing
that
model.
Yeah, I guess in the big picture, you know, Christina's right. The way I look at it also is it's the impact for us is a benefit. You know, there's, you jump on the hot lanes, it's a short ride. For those people 50 miles out, wow, big benefit. You know, they can get to work fast and, you know, they might have to pay more, but that's their benefit. They don't have any downside. We've got a downside. It's the congestion. You know, people saying, oh, that's too expensive, or, you know, let's go through the neighborhood and stuff like that. That's the difference. The, you know, the jurisdictions further down the line don't have much of a downside that I see it. So that's our issue.
Well, I will say that we, same allude to this, with the Atlantic Gateway package, we are working on a project to extend them all the way down the hot lanes, that is, the express lanes, all the way down to 17 exit 133 in Fredericksburg. The congestion is not just here.
Oh, I understand.
The congestion is all the way down to Fredericksburg. So if you choose to, if you cannot make that choice or do not want to make that choice of vehicle, you are sitting in congestion from, you know, you might only sit 9 miles of congestion, and it might take you 45 minutes. These people have started their day at 4:30 in the morning in congestion for 20, 30 miles to wherever they're going to go. So,
Amanda, I would just, I know that you have these numbers in your traffic study, maybe we can give them to Carrie, but the majority of the trips in this area originate in Fairfax, not that far south.
Yes.
There's very few people that are coming all the way, you know, so I don't want you to get the impression that that's like the majority of the traffic, because that's really not the case.
Yeah, we will get the order of destination traffic, because a lot of that is dispersed actually at the Capitol Beltway.
And that's something that was just released this week, so I know tomorrow we're going to be able to hopefully get more of a summary of that information, and we can share it. We can continue to update the commission. I do recommend that the commissioners attend the public hearing if you're able to. I know it's another meeting in the evening, but that it sounds like you'll have even more information at that, which is in a month from now. So, if there's, I'm also happy to, if there are follow-up questions, relay those to VDOT and DOBT and get back to you. But I know that we have one other item on our agenda. I don't know that VDOT needs to stay for that, but that is the Vice Chair.
Right. Yeah. Any other questions before they escape out of here?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Very informative. And
it'll be through. Don't worry. You'll get your hot lane.
Yeah. It's going to happen.
You've got to ask them. Yeah. Okay. And I guess here's a question for Jim. We'd probably know more about this. I was going to ask them, but I figured they we're going to answer it, but when they came up with this project, at some point, did they come to the city and say, hey, we're thinking about this, can we have your input? Or was that just so far above the level that they didn't have the jurisdiction?
Well, like I said, there was this original plan, was what?
About 5 years ago.
5 years ago?
Right, right.
So this is just
ongoing.
But I think that VDOT has consulted with the city staff.
Sorry, I missed the question because I just stepped
out of it. Did VDOT ever consult with that?
Did they get input from the jurisdictions?
No,
you know, we're talking about us.
About the whole project?
Right.
I
they have, I mean, I would say they've done a good job at keeping us informed of this project. So they've
That's not the question.
Did they ask us if they could do the project? I mean, I don't think they called each jurisdiction along the corridor and said, can't we do this project?
No. I'm just saying, did they ask for input about what we thought about what they're doing?
So what I would say to that is, one thing that we have been really, the answer is yes, but the one thing that we have been really providing input on is our desire, and I think Councilman Levain has done this through the different boards and commissions he's on.
What do we get out?
The Transportation Planning Board and MDC is making sure that we get that dollar amount, because that's what we were really nervous about. We wanted to make sure.
We're still nervous.
We wanted to make sure that there was a financial commitment. We wanted to see a number, and I think we didn't have that number. I think it was last spring, and there were some actions taken by those groups. So I think they're really good to make sure that we got that number, which we have now. So I feel that that has been positive. I also would say, the transit aspect of this project is completely different than the last time they've done this. There was not really a transit component, now there is. So I think that's a positive.
Yes, I agree.
But while we're on this topic, I mean, Carrie, you're very familiar with the whole Center City issues and the concerns that are ongoing. I mean, what do you see is the effect on
Express lane access. What I would prefer, since we just got that information this week, we just got the traffic information this week, and tomorrow we're looking to get some overview from them, is if I can get back to you all, because I don't have the answers tonight, but I think she provided a sort of a good level of data to show, but what I would like to see is a little bit more information so before I answer that question.
People are very concerned, and I mean, everyone I talk to in our area is like, there's one person who doesn't think there's going to be any adverse effect, but most people I've talked to think there will be.
Okay.
In Clover College Park, they sort of like knee-jerk after the fact, but I can just imagine, you know, they get a little bit more traffic from it and you know, what they're going to do, but I mean, every person I've talked to has been concerned about it. And sort of feels like it's an event that's already happened and that no one has any say. Huh? Yeah, fait accompli. Yeah.
I do have a counterpoint to offer.
Uh-huh.
We often, there's people who discuss that there's a lot of cut-through traffic. Everybody thinks that Waze is responsible and whatnot. And I think there's a simpler explanation for why neighborhoods are experiencing more traffic like that. And that's because in the past 10 years, the area has grown by a population of about 600,000 people, if I remember correctly. That's about the number of people that have moved into the D.C. metro area without really any commensurate increase in road capacity, aside from interchanges and different things. So there's not like massive amounts of new lane miles are being built or what, you know. We're just seeing some stuff, but no game changes, for example. So I think the reason for increased traffic is probably just population growth rather than just like spillover effects, just people who need to get places, there are more of them, so these are the roads. And I don't know, I'm not saying there's an answer to this, but I think that might be why these things happen.
And those studies in TPV that I talked about earlier, the analysis, per capita VMT is projected to go down, but traffic is gonna get worse because the population growth.
Exactly.
Yeah, if you see all the
statistics
what's gonna happen when you add, you know, 20 years from now, you had 2 million people. I mean,
the only solution is to get them out of cars.
I mean, I don't think I'm
blind use.
Yep.
And to Melissa's point, I think it would be important that we have the ability, particularly as a region, but I'll just speak for the city itself, to influence the decision criteria that's going to be used for the allocation of dollars for these projects. Because, again, more lanes is not an option. It's to provide viable options for people to get out of the cars and to seek reasonable alternative solutions. And the capacity is never going to increase. We're at a maximum. So to the extent to which we can influence the use of alternate transportation methods, I think is where we may have the maximum capability to make a more favorable outcome for Alexandria, to drive people into a more reasonable option.
Just to take that to one more level, I don't think VDOT's particularly used to thinking about how it could provide the options. It's used to providing and maintaining roads. But that is also runs on an underlying assumption that there's room in Virginia for more roads. And in most places, there may technically be. There's room, places they can expand.
Right, right.
It only has the minimal impact on the community. But Virginia doesn't necessarily have to have that as its priority. And the thing I equate it to is how the car companies are getting into the mobility business because they don't see their end game being producing more and more cars anymore. They actually want to get in at the ground level on other options and ways to provide a service they can monetize in a future where people won't necessarily each own their own car.
Right.
Or get rid of it every year or whatever on a new lease. So maybe VDOT needs to get into the business of mobility and think about how it could be creative in the next 50 years in not just building more roads and how that is its job, but how it can move people better and help them do what they need to do better. And it might not involve roads at all.
Yeah, my point generally is that the heart of the answer to our transportation problems is not a transportation solution, it's a land use solution. And if we just concentrate future development around our activity centers, especially our metro rail stations, walkable, bikeable communities, well served by transit, that's the heart of the answer, because you just can't build your way out.
And that gets back to your point, one of those game changer projects that are currently on the I guess TPB docket, the TOD around the metro stations, and making sure those connections are complete, because where you put the people, you still need to make sure you solve barriers to getting them to transit, to getting them to their options. And when this region, this entire metro region, does that well, you get amazing mode shares. I mean, Arlington's Crystal City area is a really good example. There's like 25% drive alone mode split there for commutes. And that's kind of unheard of in this area, unless you live in like downtown DC. And it's a land use, you can only do it with land use combined with good transportation options and helping people understand how those options work for them.
Here.
Good discussion.
Very much like the European models, which is highly successful.
Yes.
Vehicle,
okay.
Public transportation option.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which would help Center City problems.
Yeah.
Other business. First thing I forgot to do is introduce Melissa McMahon, our newest member to the Transportation Commission. And she's already showed that
yep.
She just chimes right in, which is exactly what we need. It just stimulates a discussion about. That's why we're here. We represent the city, and we oversee what staff comes, their plans. So we're the voice of the city. So we have to look at that. And that's why we're all interested in, hey, what can we do to get to the, 20 years from now, and it's, I keep looking at Route 1 and the rest of the city. When the congestion gets so bad that people have to take transit because nothing's moving.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's other modes, but okay. We've all had a good, we can chat like this because look at the time. I can't believe we're wrapping things up. Okay, talking about wrapping things up. Okay, so the vice chair. Position needs to be filled. I would prefer that we wait until all the commissioners are on board. We have the Environmental Policy Commission appointee hasn't been appointed yet, so I think, according to the schedule, that person should be...
She should be able to make the by the October meeting.
She should be sworn in. That's the timeline. So I prefer we do that before we move to vote on that. But everybody should consider that if they want to be nominated, you can nominate yourself and stuff. So, think about it. Okay.
So should people think about that in advance of the next meeting?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So, and you can do that at the meeting if you want to nominate yourself or have somebody else nominate you. Yeah, we can do that. So, any other questions on the vice chair position? It's really not that hard a job. I did it. I didn't know what I was doing. So I did after a while, though. Okay.
The ATC representative. Okay, so there's, I've had a discussion with Kerry, and I had a discussion with Jan today after 2 weeks of trying to have that discussion. There's a lot of ways, I guess, we can do this. The history shows that there should be a representative from both the ATC board and the commission to represent the other. So the way I see it, the best option, there's a lot of options we can do this. But the way I see it is the Transportation Commission should have a commissioner that is the representative on the dashboard. The dashboard should have a board member that is a representative on the Transportation Commission. This way, both the commission and the board have a voice on the other entity. As far as I can see it, for the Transportation Commission, it's one of our citizen representatives can be that representative on the board. I like, you know, the reason we had two new members in the past year is because of the workload. You know, we got a lot of things, you know, stuff comes up like the, you know, the Confederate thing. I mean, it just popped up and somebody's got to do it. So, you know, there's a lot of work to be done. So that's one of the things. Now, as far as the dashboard, I assume they have citizen representatives that can do the same thing, be a representative here. So I think that's the best option. There's other options
If I may, Mr. Chairman, the dashboard, and I can let Mr. Clay speak to this too, the dashboard is going to consider this at their retreat, I believe,
yes.
Next month. We'll be talking about this very thing that you're talking about, and so it's not a decision that the commission needs to make tonight.
I understand,
it's an important point to make, I think what I would recommend, if it's the pleasure of the commission, is for the board to have the retreat and have some outputs out of that retreat that I could then share with the Transportation Commission at our October meeting.
Okay.
If that's the pleasure of this group, I could do that.
Okay.
And refresh my memory on the current arrangement.
So the current arrangement is that Ms. McClay is sitting on the Transportation Commission, but coincidentally also sitting on the dashboard.
Coincidentally, or which one was first?
I'm the dashboard's representative to the Transportation Commission.
Okay.
But why can't you do both?
Yeah, that's what I thought you did.
No. Well, so
there's no prohibition.
There is no prohibition.
So
it got kind of messed up when Kerry Donnelly was sitting on the commission, and I think first he was on the board, and then.
It's essentially not in the DASH bylaws right now to have a formal
it's not.
Representative from DASH to the Transportation Commission, but that's what they're going to be discussing next month. And I think after that discussion, I can update all of you, and that way we can. But I don't think tonight it necessarily needs to be an action item of the commission, because we don't have anything to have action on. But I can certainly let you know how that discussion goes, and then we can further.
You could bring that up as one of the options. I mean, we're not voting
the same position.
Each have one. That's the option that I feel is probably beneficial to both entities.
Because your comment about the citizen representatives, there are city representatives that sit on the board by designated to do that. The balance of the board members, which is probably five, are citizen representatives.
So,
okay.
As I understand it, back in 2013, there was an MOU about the makeup of the ATC board, right? And it had five citizen representatives,
yes.
Two staff, city manager and TNES, mm-hmm. and a Transportation Commission representative. So that was the intended layout at that time. I wasn't, you know, part of that process, but the intention of that was the Transportation Commission had a designee whose job it was to represent the point of view of the Transportation Commission to the board. But right now we have you as you were elected to the board, and then assigned to Transportation Commission. Right. So I think this, while it feels like a technicality, it's kind of about the spirit of the appointment. So it's not as simple as one person could do both, unless perhaps it was that person was simultaneously appointed to both boards by city council or how it's selected. But I get the impression that those two entities are appointed differently, and therefore the city council may have a different level of input or there may be a different spin on how they're constituted. So that
I don't believe that the city council has I would have to double check this, but I don't believe that the city council would have a role in the DASH.
I believe that's correct.
Yeah,
I believe that's
because it's part of the DASH bylaws.
Right. And there has never been a Transportation Commission person on the board, the DASH board of directors.
Right.
I suspect that the MOU was implemented, and perhaps that element was not, but I wouldn't be assured that it was.
Right, and so I think it may be that the intent of
that
was to bring the city council through a transparent appointment process, which already exists in the Transportation Commission, that level of a level of transparent participation in the dashboard. And so just to put that out there is sort of why there would be a consideration that there'd be a value in that particular way is acknowledging that being appointed to the Transportation Commission is a different thing than being appointed to the dashboard in terms of how it's done in a public
place.
That's
right.
A good distinction. There is a different process for
Okay, I think.
So I think it's good we've had that. What I would like to do is just after the retreat, update the commission on kind of what the outputs of that were so that the commission can talk about it further the next year.
Okay, yeah, right. Just put our options on the table there. It's still evolving.
Okay. Thank
you. Okay, any other business? Silence. 20 after, boy. It's nice. Okay, no other business. Meetings adjourned. How can we have a
move to adjourn?
Move to adjourn.
1 second.
Okay, out of here.
Approved.
Yep.
I'm signing back and checks out of the bank.
You're like, I want this money.
No, you play
I like never go to the bank, but like
hey,
my
Dave,
bank
Dave.
Is right there.
Did
you
I see
have
you
to sign it for
the
deposit?
That case?
The last time, like,
that in
the last time that I like
that case you were
the
on
the Purple Line case.
Mm-hmm. The last time
that would be right.
Yeah, the
sent one in.
The judge, I reported in June that the judge was skeptical.
He issued his decision in early August.
It was on that much say.
I know, right?
The government has moved for reconsideration.
Oh, they have.
Now it's back in the judge's hands.
I'm a lawyer. I know. What's the basis of
what?
What's the basis of reconsideration? What error was there? So
like, give me money.
They're just arguing with his decision.
Re-arguing?
Yeah.
Well, that's not going to explain.
I've never.
So you know that you buy time, and who knows what happens as you buy time? You know what I mean?
Exactly.
I read that and I was like, oh, good job.
Finally,
I thought that was what you were talking about.
Finally, at the last minute, on Monday, both Montgomery and Prince George's counties got interested in this case and asked to file amicus briefs. We said they were too late. We'll see what he says.
Well, hello. Wow.
How are you doing?
Good luck with that. Thank you, Lisa.
Well,
your input is.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.